and welcome to a very special edition of the Fremantle Press podcast called Love to Read Local Radio. Love to Read Local is a statewide initiative to celebrate and showcase Western Australia's many, many wonderful writers and illustrators and the books they create. As you will note, I am not your usual host, Rebecca Higgy. This is Holden Shepherd here, and I've come back online as your podcast host just for this episode. I'm a West Aussie novelist and the author of the award-winning coming-of-age novel, Invisible Boys. I'm absolutely stoked today to be joined by a powerhouse guest, the best-selling and award-winning YA author, AJ Betts. Welcome, AJ.
Hey, thanks, Holden. I'm stoked too.
It's going to be fun. I can just feel it.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to start first by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and your latest book series, which is it's a duology, I believe. Is that the right word?
It is the right word. I had to learn that word as well. So I'm AJ Betts. My name is Amanda, but I write under AJ Betts. Yeah, I'm a local here in WA. I've been here 16 years, so I think that counts me as a local. Thank you. And a writer, obviously, and I have 5 novels published for young adults. They include Shutter Speed by Fremantle Press, Wavelength by Fremantle Press, Zach and Mia by Text, and Hive and Road by Pam McMillan. So Hive and Road are a duology, as you say. It's a 2-book series, which is nothing like anything I've written before. Usually I write realism, but this series is what you might call speculative fiction or science fiction. So it's set in a different place, in a future setting. So, I'm sure we'll talk more about it. But that's my recent publications. And I'm really excited to talk to you about them.
Yeah, no, I have so many questions. I finished reading Hive and Rogue over the last few days, and I love them. They are brilliant, by the way. I don't know if I've had the chance to kind of tell you that.
Thank you.
They're brilliant, brilliant books. I had a few places I wanted to start, but I was actually, since you mentioned spec fic, I might dive in with that. I'm curious about how we categorise these things. So you called them spec fic, but I mean, these books, having just read them, there's elements of dystopian fiction, some fantasy, definitely some sci-fi, they're YA, there's a coming-of-age theme. I mean, how did you decide how to categorise and kind of brand these novels and you know, what's the process around that?
Yeah, it's something that I don't do until right at the end when I'm working with the publisher. When I'm writing, I don't know, I'm just finding my way, and I certainly didn't set out to write something like this. It's, I had the idea and it evolved, and then I'm like, what am I writing? So the way that I categorize it really is, you're right, it has aspects of all of these genres. Speculative fiction is an umbrella term, I guess, a possible future, really, or a possible way of life that isn't really a way of life that we might have now. So in that broad way of seeing speculative fiction, definitely you can fit dystopia, you can fit zombie apocalypses, you can fit science fiction and even fantasy. So some people call it dystopia. Definitely has elements of that, but I really try when I'm writing to not think about the genre, and I actively avoid reading books in that genre as well, because I want to let the story unfold as it needs to and find its own its own method for being told. So I just leave that up to the booksellers and the publisher to work out how to categorize it. But for me, it just feels like the only way of telling the story. Is that useful?
No, that totally makes sense. It sounds like your process is you've got to service the story first, and the story is what drives everything else. And however the story ends up, that's what, you know, other people can categorize it, as you say.
The way I see Hive and Rogue, I feel like they're real, even though they're not. This place isn't real and this future isn't real. it feels completely believable to me. So I'm not writing science fiction set on another planet for which the technology doesn't exist. I'm writing something which is a possible near future. In that way, I guess I identify more with the way Margaret Atwood describes speculative fiction is rather than, I'm going to misquote her, but it's not alien octopuses in space. Or I don't know what the quote was, but it's a possible future that touches on our own present, and you can see direct threads from our present into that. So maybe one day I might tackle pure science fiction or high fantasy even. But for this project, I wanted it to feel like it could be possible. So that's why I kind of use speculative fiction, as a broad term.
Yeah, no, I think spec fic as a catch-all really works, especially for this duology. But I also want to ask you about the idea of wonder, because you're the only person I've ever come across who has a PhD in that specialisation, and I feel like Hive and Rogue are really peppered throughout with wonder. I mean, in Hive, you've got Hayley wondering about the limitations of her own world, and then in Rogue, there are brand new discoveries. So was it important to you from the start of this project that wonder would be like this undercurrent through the two books?
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you for asking about this. And it's something, working with wonder is something that I've only become aware of through doing my PhD. So I didn't set out to do a PhD in wonder originally. It was going to be about dystopia and young adult fiction. But then I got 6 months into my PhD and realised I didn't really care about that. And so I took some time thinking, what do I care about in my writing? What is a thread that goes through all of my work? And what matters to me most? And in the creative process and also in the stories that people read. I took some time, worked it out, and it kept coming back to this idea of wonder. And I guess a simple way of describing what wonder is a sense of astonishment at the world. And I think I feel this as an adult, and I think it's just a wonderful quality that young people have, and unfortunately through real life demands, it's something that we can forget about how amazing this experience is. So yeah, I've seen it in my previous novels, and when I was writing Hive and Rogue and doing my PhD, it was definitely an impetus behind Hayley's motivation, but it was also in my sense of creating these worlds. So yeah, I did want the reader, and I hopefully in whatever I write, I do want the reader, young adult or adult or whoever, to feel that sense of astonishment at what is possible through these stories. So obviously in speculative fiction I can play with that concept on a bigger scale. But yeah, it was definitely fun to see Hayley in these worlds. In a way, I was thinking of like Alice in Wonderland, that sense of the rules have been subverted, really, and that anything is possible. And with that strangeness and with that the uncanny comes empowerment and delight. And yeah, that's what I wanted to that's one of the things I wanted to convey in Hive and Rogue. And yeah, as you say, came out with a PhD in wonder. I had to write other things besides the two novels, but I'm really glad that you mentioned that and you feel that sense in the novels.
Oh, totally. I mean, as I was reading it, you're feeling like you're discovering, I mean, even in Hive, you feel like you're discovering that world of Hive. Even though Hayley already lives there, the way it's written, you're really feeling quite wondrous at, you know, different things that are used and things we don't need a fever for you, like, oh, what's that about, you know? And what are the Nethers doing, you know, like what is their job? And you're trying to work out how that corresponds to a human, normal profession that we know about. So it definitely came across wonderfully. What was it like doing a creative PhD? I mean, I can't imagine it's all happy and wondrous. I mean, there must have been some heavy research time that made you kind of tear your hair out or something.
Yeah, well, as you know, Holden, writing a book in itself is it's not all joyful as well. There's a whole lot of going off on tangents and second guessing yourself and doubting and rewriting. And in a way, it's kind of like that. Doing a creative writing PhD, it allowed me to indulge my interest in research. Actually, I really like research, so not just for Hive and Rogue, but also in the creative process. So just becoming more aware of what I'm doing rather than just, you know, keeping on going with the manuscript. I'm stopping and reflecting on how it's actually coming together. And so that was a really lovely opportunity, I guess. So, and as you just heard, I love research. Hive and Rogue, oh my gosh, so much research went into these. I know that these are made up places, but everything is plausible and possible. I can tell you all about the sustainability behind it, and you know, like you say, the Feeb of You and the science behind that. So I really spend a lot of time researching doing the PhD kind of made me feel okay about that rather than I'm time wasting. And I'm a big fan of academic writing. I'm such a nerd as well. So I actually really enjoyed that. Having said that, it's now lovely to just be back in a creative process and working on my new book. And that's my main focus rather than splitting it. So, yeah, it was wonderful. I was really lucky to have a scholarship through ECU and have some wonderful supervisors. It was an excellent experience, and I recommend it if you're interested in doing that, Holden.
Oh, I'm scared. I'm too scared.
What?
I did graduate. I've got first class honours, and I was encouraged years ago to go on to a PhD, and I just went, scary.
If you know what you want to do, like, it's fine. There's no need to do a creative PhD. I mean, I'd already had 3 books published before I went and did it because there were things I wanted to learn about in the writing process. And as you say, writing about genre or writing from a different viewpoint. So I found that really, really helpful. You got plenty of time.
Yeah, I'll fill that in somewhere. You mentioned some of the research that you did. And in the acknowledgements of Rogue, you talk about some of the physical settings that you reappropriated for fiction in terms of Maria Island and Terra Firma. I know you've been to, I don't know if I want to spoil where that actually is, where that's based on or not, but you've been to this location in real life. Was that the starting of, like, was that, without using too much of a Hive Rogue pun, was that like the seed from which this story grew?
Oh, no, it's not the seed, but it came early on. So Hive, I guess I should, for the listeners, help them a little bit. Well, yeah, Hive is set in an enclosed community. I won't tell you where because that's part of their discovery. But it has 300 people living in this community sometime in the future. And this is the only community they know. Rogue, which is the sequel, takes place mostly in a future Australia, mostly in Tasmania and then some of mainland Australia as well. The seed actually for the whole project came about many years ago, actually in 2005, when I was driving through the Graham Farmer Freeway Tunnel here in Perth. And the traffic was really slow and I noticed a drip coming from the ceiling. And seriously, it was, and by the way, I found out that the following year that was fixed. It had been raining outside. I was driving through really slowly through traffic and I noticed a drip and I thought, that's weird. I didn't think, oh my gosh, we're going to die because I realized the tunnels could withstand rain. But sometimes these little things can spark curiosity and questioning. What that sparked for me was, okay, I'm safe. The tunnel will not collapse. But in what situation would a drip be a problem or a danger? And one thing led to another. And the next thing I was thinking about is, an underwater community. And it begins with Hayley finding a drip. And so I had this idea in 2005. But in a way, I was scared. I didn't start writing it then. I was writing my first book, Shutter Speed. And I was scared because it felt like something too big and too hard. And I started writing it properly in 2013. So that's where the idea came from. And it, from that question of how could a drip be a problem, it led to this underwater feed vault, this underwater structure which exists, and it begins with the drip. Now, the setting for book two, Rogue, Tasmania, I wasn't sure actually, but I like the idea of an island setting because I could manipulate it. I could manipulate it in a better way. I thought then if something as huge as the Australian mainland. So in that way, I chose something manageable. So in 2013, I went to Tassie and I took my bike and I rode around the island looking for settings. And I thought it'd be on the west coast, on the shore. But when I arrived, it's near the central east coast, an island called Morai Island. I just went there for a day trip, and as soon as the ferry arrived, I just knew, and I just spent the day just exploring, and there were wombats and echidnas and Tassie, well, weren't Tassie devils at the time, there are now. It was just fascinating, and I felt that that certainty that this is where my book should be set. And I went back and spent more time there in my research. So, yeah, it was really important that to create this setting that felt real and it is based on its current environment, I guess, because even though it's a future story, I needed to feel that, like I said, possible and plausible. So getting that setting was really important to me. And that helped create the story that followed in Rogue. Setting is really important. I have to nail that early and really have a sense of it myself, as I know you do as well.
Yeah, I loved it being set in a version of Australia, and or partly in some ways. I love. So this reminds me of something years ago. When I think I saw like a head of, I don't know, it was a major Aussie TV network kind of saying that, well, they don't produce Aussie TV shows that are kind of spec fic because, you know, local audiences wouldn't believe that would happen here. And I remember someone pointing out to him, well, you know, Twilight happens in a small town in America. And like, you know, there's all kinds of examples of overseas where something can be set in you know, a real location or inspired by a real location. And audiences are totally there for it. And I was totally there for this. Do you have thoughts on that? Like, did you do that deliberately thinking, I want, you know, Aussie spec fic out there?
No, it's not deliberate. But I really value Australian stories. And I think that our settings are just as rich as any setting, really. You know, I guess there's this longstanding cultural cringe, which has shifted. But for a long time, it was felt that you need to set something, you know, in a place that's more exotic or more exciting. And I'm like, no, this place that we are in now in WA or whether it's Tasmania, it is rich with potential. So yeah, all of my stories are set in Australian places that are easily identifiable, and that's really important to me. And that's, you know, an element of feedback that I get from readers as well. They really love identifying with the place and seeing places that they recognise brought to life. But I think it was really fun to create a future Australia. So I'm hoping that the changes with TV, as you say, TV and film, it'd be really nice to see, more Australian spec fic represented. That'd be amazing.
Like I would be there for that. I would tune into a show that, you know, mm-hmm. or you know, a Hive Rogue adaptation, for instance.
Thanks.
I'd be there for that.
That'd be awesome.
I had another question. Just it sparked from something you said about when you thought of this idea. So you thought, you know, you had the very first thought about this in 2005. Started writing in 2013. I feel, and it's going to sound like totally out of left field, but I feel like I remember something mentioned at some point that this was originally one book, and it might have been something on your Twitter account years ago, and I'm maybe making it up. But was it always going to be two books, or was it originally one, and then you decided to split it? I mean, how did you decide to craft and structure these two books?
I wish I could see forward and have a bigger picture view of these things. And me be more deliberate with these big decisions. But I just have to feel my way. Originally, I thought it would be one book, and I thought it would end at the end of Hive. But as you know, Holden, it ends on such a cliffhanger, and I thought I can't do it. And besides, I actually wanted to know where she went to and what that led to. So, and then I thought, oh, this might be a trilogy, because especially at the time I was writing, trilogies were so big, especially in YA spec fic. Like, I'm thinking The Hunger Games, and I don't, I can't think of any more off the top of my head. But people just
Divergent.
Thank you. Or even The Knife of Never Letting Go by Patrick Ness. It's just, maybe people expect if it's a one book or it's a trilogy. So I thought I'll write a trilogy. And then I was through book two, and then I had a plan for, well, I was getting through book two, and then I had a plan for book three, but then I thought, I don't want it to be a disappointing third. The way, sorry to the authors out there who created disappointing thirds, but I just have an experience as a reader of reading the final third book of a trilogy often being disappointed. So I thought, why don't I just make a killer second book and leave it at that? So Rogue is a bit bigger than Hive, and a lot happens in different settings, and a lot happened. There's a huge arc, which I could have stretched out, but I thought, no, I want to do the right thing by the readers and not make them hang out for a third. So it kind of fell into that. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't a deliberate thing. I could have put them, both books, into one big book. I don't know if I made the right decision, but it just felt right at the time. And my publisher, Pan McMillan, was happy to go with the two. Who knows how these things work? I just kind of feel my way as I'm going there and hope that I'm making the right decisions.
I think you did. I mean, like, I loved it. And, like, two books work so well. And it felt like such a natural conclusion at the end of Rogue. The payoff, I think, I don't know if I've already said this, but the payoff is really superb. And even in that last, I would say the last half, maybe the last third of Rogue, I was reading and kind of, as a writer myself, I was kind of reading it going like, oh, wow, because you were, the twists and turns that were coming through, like, all made sense, but you were like, you could have taken this any number of ways. I was actually really thinking, like, you could have done a number of different things to take that book into a trilogy or a series of five books if you wanted to, or it could have gone down a number of different roads. But I just thought that was really masterful. And I mean, you've had five books published now. Is that something that you learn with time? I guess I'm asking, how do I get better?
Okay, I don't know. I'm still asking people how I get better as well. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. I just, I don't know how to write a book when I start to write a book, because I haven't written that book. So every time I start, I'm just trying to work out the story and find it. The only way to get better is just to keep going. And it's interesting that you say that it could have gone another ways, and I could have stretched that. Absolutely, I've had so many readers email me saying, please write a third book. I'm like, no, actually, that you can imagine it if you want, but I like that there are gaps and silence. I like that the readers can fill these in for them. And I like having these twists and turns. So there's no way to do this. And I'm, you know, I'm working on a realistic book at the moment. And as I said, I'm just working it out as I go. And for me, I spend most of my time with revision, because once you get through the first draft, that's only when you can tell what you're dealing with. And then you start playing. And that's what I love. I love treating it like a huge jigsaw puzzle and pushing things around and taking things out and just trying to find the right shape for what it needs to be and get that pace just right. So like you say, you're never lingering on anything too much or stretching it out. But just touching on it and moving on in a, hopefully, a way that's satisfying. I don't know. I just keep working it out. Sorry, Holden.
That's all right. I'll just
I think you're doing all right.
Nah, thank you. I'm trying. you've mentioned working on something new at the moment, so I guess that might be a good place for me to come to and bring this interview to is, you know, what's next for you?
Oh, okay, thanks. It's back to realism for me. It's something I've had the idea for a good 4 years, And I've been keeping that in a part of my brain until I had the time and the headspace for that. So it's actually set back in WA. It's in Perth, and it's about a teenage rock band, actually. I might have to pick your brains about, with all your music knowledge. It's about a teenage band who is recording a song. They're all in year 12, and it's their final chance to enter Triple J Unearthed High competition. And it's all set over one weekend in one main location as they're working on a song. So I guess it's got elements of the Breakfast Club in that regard, but I see it kind of like that, kind of like a music documentary, kind of, I don't know, as I said, I'm working through it. I'm about a third of the way through. I'm just working, trying to get the first third in a good shape. But before I move on to the second third, I'm trying a different way of working at the moment. But yeah, it's fun. I want it to be fun because I haven't written like a comedy as such before. Mm-hmm. Like Hard and Rogue were pretty intense, and before that Zach and Me was pretty intense, and before anyway, you get the idea. So I just really wanted to play this time more with relationships, I guess, rather than the ideas that I played with in my previous book. So yeah, I'm having real fun with it and working out the characters as I go and working out the right structure. So that's what I'm doing. I'm having fun.
It sounds like it's going to be really fun and probably wondrous as well, not to be
excited.
Working in the wonder.
Nicely done.
I'm coming back to,
again, when I read your book and Invisible Boys and just finished yesterday, am I allowed to talk to you about this now? Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely. Let's flip it all around. I'd be glad to.
Good. I would like this very much. Thank you for asking me wonderful questions. But reading yours, because it's so character-based, so do we need to tell the readers a little bit about the book?
Yes.
All right. Absolutely. Maybe I'll leave you do that. Maybe if you explain a little bit and then I'll interrogate you, if that's okay.
For sure. So Invisible Boys is the story of three teenage boys, all 16 years old, growing up in Geraldton, Western Australia, which is my hometown. The book is fiction, but it's around these three very different boys, Zeke, Charlie and Hammer. One's a nerd, one's a punk, one's a jock. And they're all very different, but they've all got the fact that they're gay and they come to terms with their sexuality in ways that, you know, some of them are kind of okay with, some of them are very confronted by, and some of them are in denial about. So the book is following their interwoven journeys, and then in between those three points of view, there's a series of anonymous letters. I've called them letter bombs. And those letters are from one of the boys. We don't know which one. But the boy writing them is very much in distress, and he's getting increasingly distressed and talking about potentially taking his own life. So the kind of the thrust of the whole novel is trying to follow the thread of what's happening and, you know, who is the boy writing the letters? Can he be saved? Will he be saved? In a nutshell.
That was a good nutshell.
Thank you. I pride myself on nutshells.
Thank you. Thank you for writing this book. It was so powerful and really... Yeah, really emotional, and I'm so glad I get to talk to you about it because I want to talk to someone about it. and I've heard you speak about your book before. So what I have heard you say is that the three main characters, Charlie, Zeke and Hammer, all have different elements of you and your experience. So you've kind of split your own experience into these three characters and fictionalize them, of course. But I won't ask, which is most like you, I want to ask which of these, Charlie, Zeke or Hammer, was the hardest to write about and which was the most fun?
Oh, that is a great question, and I've never been asked that before. I do often
You've
get
asked
which one.
A lot of questions. Okay.
Yeah, no, that's why I love it when I get a question. I'm like, well, I've never been asked that. Because people are often like, which one are you?
Yeah, I'm not going to ask that because they're all very different, obviously. And they all have these difficult circumstances and difficult. Mm. Anyway, I don't want to say too much about what actually happened. But who was hardest for you to write?
So I would say I would say Zeke was the hardest to write because, so Zeke is the good Catholic boy and he struggles with the kind of moral implications of homosexuality and what that might mean for him, his family, his identity. And diving back into that, I think was probably the hardest part of, actually probably the letter bombs were the hardest part of writing the book, but in terms of the three characters and writing their narratives, Zeke's was hardest because I think it made me kind of have to revisit and confront who I used to be in high school. Like, I used to be Zeke and, you know, I was very withdrawn and self-loathing and incredibly shy, and I would kind of, like having to go back and face that when I'm probably a lot more like Charlie or Hammer these days. It was really hard to go back and have to kind of really honestly face that, you know, I grew up feeling like a loser and a nerd and like I couldn't really reconcile my sexuality and the faith that I had at the time. So that's, I'm taking it down to a deep place, sorry.
No, he's a beautiful character and I love his vulnerability. And he is such a brave character as well. Without going into what happens through the book, he's it's really wonderful to watch his arc.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad. I didn't answer the other part of the question, which was the most fun. Was that right?
It doesn't have to be one of the main characters. Maybe even one of the smaller characters. Was there someone in particular you just couldn't wait to get back to writing or creating the choice for?
Do you know what? It actually was Hammer, which is one of the main characters. But I had so much fun writing as Hammer because I could just let my ego run wild, and you know, in a fictional place on a page where it can't hurt anyone, I could really be a bit of a douche, and that was really fun to kind of step into that role.
Yeah, he does say some douchey things,
right?
As a character. But then again, we've all known people like him. I'm like, I went to school with a few guys like that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Thank you for explaining that. And you mentioned Geraldton before. You're a Gerald boy, and that's where it's at. And I'm sure people have asked you about this before, but I couldn't help but touch on it. The setting is so beautifully told, so evocatively told. And, you know, I've been to Geraldton a number of times, but I got to see it from different in a different way, from the town to the canola fields. So I guess my question isn't about how you created the setting so beautifully and accurately, but I want to know, how do the Geraldton locals feel about having their place represented in these ways?
Good call, because I was so worried about how this book would be received back home. Because I didn't really, like, I have not written this as, like, a tourism ad, like, come to Geraldton and you know, stay in our hotels and see our lovely beaches. It's really kind of, it's just kind of telling it like it is. But the funny thing is that everyone back home, not everyone, I mean, I can't speak for a whole town, but everyone I've had contact with or who has contacted me has kind of praised the way the town is shown. Which was a surprise because I thought there might be a lot of people going, oh, how could you not, you know, say how much you love the town? Because I think Charlie's very first line in the book is that, you know, it's a poxy shithole of a town. I was kind of like, I think just before the book came out, about a week before, I did start to think like, oh, what have I done? You know, like that's going out in the world. People will think that's me saying that, not my character. But thankfully, everyone's kind of said, like, the people who are in Geraldton now have gone, yep, this is really realistic. And, you know, this is how the town is. The people who've left Geraldton are like, yep, that's totally what Jarrah's like. And, you know, that's why I left. But I have, like, bulk affection for my hometown. And I was glad to be able to, I did an event in the Geraldton Library kind of during the kind of book tour promo phase of this being out back in October last year. And I was able to kind of say, like, I have bulk affection for this town. Like, I still love it. I still call it home. I still, like, within 5 minutes of meeting someone, I'm like, and I'm a Gerro boy. because it's just everything I've ever known. And if I could live there, I think I would. But there's just not, you know, there's not the same opportunities or work or anything like that in a smaller regional town. But yeah, thankfully, people have received it really well, and they've loved the kind of references to Drelton locations. And I particularly wanted to have urban settings in a town. I've read a lot. Anything I ever read about Geraldton seemed to always be about, like, that wouldn't be in Geraldton, it'd be like, oh, we're on the Crave Oaks, or we're in, you know, somewhere inland, and you're just looking at beautiful natural landscapes, which are great, but it wasn't like the town that I grew up with, and I wanted to show the town.
That's absolutely right. I could totally see it. And I loved imagining and moving around. You could actually do a tour. You could do an Invisible Boys walking tour, really, of the different locations.
Oh, yes.
Go
that
on.
Would work, right?
Yeah, I think that could work. Working with Big Sky Festival, see what you can do. That'd be awesome. And then you could have, anyway, I'm going off on tangent, but you could totally have people reenacting some of the scenes. I'd love to have people
egging people in the nightclub line.
That's what I was just thinking. Yes, line up for that. That'd be amazing. Thank you. I think you show it with love, and I think you show people with love as well. And one word that kept coming to me as I was reading it was kindness. I mean, honesty, but kindness, and Zeke especially is someone who really embodies that. And I think that's the way that you asked me about wonder. I think, you know, this is your wonder in Invisible Boys. This is the kindness thread all the way through, and treating people gently and compassionately. I think that's a wonderful message. This isn't a question. I'm just turning this in.
That's really nice to hear.
Yeah, and I was wondering if that was something deliberate. Okay, I'll turn it into a question. Was that something deliberate that you chose to do? I think this is a theme I want to pull through. Or is it more of a reflection on you as a person?
Well, it's both, because both of those things are kind of part of the same driver that I have, which is I want to write from a place of wholeness. So I wanted to kind of see these boys as humans, and I deliberately showed their good side and their bad side, and probably more their bad side. My idea was that they were invisible, I mean, for a number of reasons, their sexuality being one of the big ones, but I wanted to write a book where you're seeing teenage boys without supervision or control or influence from, you know, parents, teachers, anyone who might make them behave well. And I wanted to see, like, this is what happens when boys are not seen by the adults in their lives. This is what's going on in their heads. This is what they're doing physically. This is what they're doing sexually. This is how they feel. And so that's kind of what inspired me to go into a really place of wholeness and show the good and the bad, the light and the dark. So that, and I guess that comes from, a place of wanting to be compassionate to my own self in terms of, you know, everyone has light and dark, right? Like we all have good things about ourselves and we'll have bad things about ourselves. And I guess I like seeing the bad things shown as much as the good, and having compassion for the characters. So someone like Hammer, for instance, yes, he comes across really douchey, and yeah, he probably is a bit of a douche, but he's also damaged, and he's also confused, and he's also he's got a kind heart somewhere, you know, beneath the bullying streak. And so I just want to show all of it and be humanistic about it, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Beautifully done. Thank you.
Thanks.
Can I ask you one more question?
Totally.
About process? Is that okay?
Yes.
Because I had a look at the acknowledgements, and among other things, you're really generous in saying thank you to different people and different organisations who've helped you over the years, such as Writing WA or the Australian Society of Authors or mentors or your writing group or teachers. And you also mentioned This Goes Against the idea of a lonely writer. And this is something I just have observed in your writing and all the things you've done before you're published and all the things you're doing now that you're after you're published. You're so engaged in the community in wanting to be a better writer and be a better mentor as well to other people. So I guess I just wanted to comment on that and ask you how important that is to have that support and that encouragement, and how you're going to is this still going to be important for you now that you've created a successful profile for yourself? Are you still going to be engaged in these writing groups? And I don't know how you have all the time, to be honest.
Well,
the notion of you not being a lonely writer the idea of being a part of a community as a writer.
Well, and I do have much less time now. You're right. Because I'm struggling to fit in all those things I used to fit in. And I'll probably pick your brains at some point saying, how do I do it? And I'm guessing...
I'll say, I don't know, but sure.
I just feel... But I mean, eventually something probably do have to drop off or something. I don't know, because you physically can't fit in. I find it hard fitting in writing and promo. But they're two different muscles. And if I have to do anything to do with promo or an event or an interview or an appearance, like to write that day becomes much, much harder. So, about the question about community stuff, I think it's honestly, I don't come from a background of, and this is not a diss to my family at all, but I come from a very working class background in a country town. So I didn't come from anything in terms of being in the writing world. Like I had nothing and I had no connections and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I still often feel like I don't know what I'm doing. But I think finding other people was kind of my way to get into this world, because like I obviously have to write a good book, and that's just, there's no way around. You have to write good books and tell really good stories and tell them well to get published. But as you say, there's a whole community thing around getting yourself to that level. And I feel like I just had to look outside of myself and try to find other people who got me. And do you know what I mean? Like, and I'm sure you found this. I know you're a member of Squibby and things like that. If you have a conversation with someone who's not a writer and you say something like, hey, I got this residency at Varuna, they'll be like, what's Varuna? Mm-hmm. Or they'll be like, okay, well, good for you. And they'll move on. Whereas if you tell a writer, they're like, oh, wow, that's so amazing. And, you've been working all your life and you've been working for 20 years trying to write this book and finally you've had a little win and sure, it's not published yet, but that's really exciting. And other writers will really get it. And you then do the same back to them. Like you get their life and you hear about them and you help them and you just become a whole community of people trying to elevate each other. And that to me is what that whole community is about. Like, I don't know about other industries. My perception is that writing is more collegiate than maybe some other performing arts, or maybe less so, I don't know. But I feel like writing is very much like everyone is there to help each other, everyone lifts each other up. And I feel like I've been lifted up by a lot of fellow authors, both when I was starting, indie authors and emerging authors, and then as I built a bit more steam, established authors would actually support and talk to you as well, which was lovely. You were actually one of the very first authors who were like a real published author who actually, interacted with me in any way on Twitter, I think. I do remember this.
I did see you in the audience a number of times at the Perth Writers Festival, and I'm just like, good for you. You've been working really hard and opening your head and your heart to all of these influences and knowledge and just really wanting to be a better writer. And that's one of the best things you can do is come along to those kind of things and interact. And you've been doing obviously all the right things. But yeah, you're right. We're so lucky here in WA, I want to say as well. I think a lot of the other states are really envious of us because we do have such a small and supportive community here where we do want to elevate each other, whether you're writing YA or adult or children's, it's I feel
that I am encouraged. And yeah, it's finding my tribe. I love my tribe so much. And you're absolutely right. You can offload all kinds of things and they get it. And I'm really glad that, yeah, you found this wonderful tribe here. And it's great to see the huge support around your award-winning book as well from all kinds of readers, but also published authors as well. Yeah, finding our tribe. It's kind of back to Invisible Boys. It's one of the themes here is finding your people and being okay with that. In a way, that's Hive and Rogue as well, but we don't need to...
Well, actually, yes, it is. It's a through line through all our work, can we say.
Finding your people. Thank you for explaining that. And you're right about time as well. There's only so much you can do. And when you present or when you do interviews or whatever, it all takes from the same basket of energy that you have. And that you only have so much energy every day. And it's really hard to switch from one or the other. So I've had to, like last year when I was doing some, I spent 3 months touring with Rogue, and there was no...
You can I say, you did huge amounts. Like, I remember watching you on tour, because I think we went for the... I think you toured for Rogue just before I toured for Invisible Boys.
And yeah.
I remember watching and going, oh, my God, like, another flight. You must be about to fall asleep in the middle of doing something. Like, you must be exhausted. Was that...
I tried that
Sorry,
one.
I interrupted
I'll
you,
never but... do that again. No, it was absolutely exhausting. But I just felt that Rogue was such a good book, and I wanted to do whatever I could to connect with other people, booksellers and readers and book clubs and whatnot. So, for 3 months, and I gave it everything. But now I'm back in my shell, which I love. Now it's just writing. I'm not in promo mode. And that's a different kind of energy I'm using, and it's a quieter energy. But... there are seasons, I guess, where you're either in promo or you're in writing, and I see them as so different but both so important. And I have actually come to the point of making that mental switch. Who am I today? Am I Amanda writing the books, or am I AJ talking about the books? And remembering that both of them will exhaust you. So keeping... Yeah, some energy for yourself and some headspace for yourself is important, but you'll work it out. You're doing great.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. but it does sound like it's the kind of thing where, like, I think at some point you do need to do, as you say, like you go into your shell and you probably don't do promo for X amount of weeks or months, which is something I think because I'm so new and I've come through that place of it's all new, I haven't had this for very long. I go, oh my God, I can't say no to, like, if someone wants me for promo, I'm like, yes, I'll be there. because I don't want to, you know, start saying no to things, because then that might never happen again. But I think
it will keep happening.
That's really nice to hear.
it feels like that. You think this opportunity will never come again. Absolutely. And you want to do the best for the book. But at some point you have to think, what is this? Like, what is the end game of this, and what is the most important thing to me right now? And it might be writing, or it might be rest, it might be reading. So after this, before I went back into writing mode, I think I had a couple of months of just reading mode. I wanted to be not talking. I wanted to be a reader rather than a speaker or a creator. I wanted just to feel that part of me again and reconnect with that before I had the energy to write. So... But absolutely, it can feel a bit pulled in different directions, and but you'll work it out. And you set aside like a whole 2 weeks where I'm not doing any promos. This is just important writing time. Plus your job, you know, we all have jobs as well.
Fantastic.
It's a constant juggling act.
It really is, but I feel like I've learned how to juggle from our chat today. So thank you so much for being so generous with both answering questions about Hive and Rogue, and then allowing me to talk about Invisible Boys as well, and frankly for teaching me what to do next with my career. I'll be implementing some of these things.
We just make it up as we go and hope for the best. So thank you for the great chat. I've really appreciated it.
Hey, no worries. It was a fantastic chat and really, really appreciate your time. Before we do finish off this episode of Love to Read Local Radio, which, by the way, I suspect is much longer than it was meant to be because I think they have just chatted.
Okay.
So, whoops. But we also love to recommend WA books when we're doing these conversations. So I am going to recommend Emily Paul's book, Well Behaved Women, which is probably off-brand for me. But it's a wonderful collection by a debut WA author, and I recommend people check it out. There's a book, there's a story at the very end of this collection, and it is amazing because it's about, I think it's called The Woman at the Writers' Festival. I think I've got the title right, but it's about writerly jealousy and going to writers' festivals and being jealous of other writers, and it is so on point, even though, you know, we don't often talk about writer jealousy. So my recommendation is that Well Behaved Women by Emily Paul, which is out by Margaret River Press. AJ, do you have a recommendation of a WA book?
Thank you. That's a great recommendation too, by the way. Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to recommend Devil's Ballast by Meg Caddy, who's a local author. Her dad is also a Fremantle Press author, David Caddy. So Devil's Ballast is Meg Caddy's second novel. It's YA. It's upper YA. It's about, it's based on the true story of Anne Bonny, who was a pirate in the 18th century. So it is a swashbuckling, fun novel, but it's also, you know, violent and cheeky and playful. So beautifully depicts life at sea and a rollicking tale. That's by Text Publishing.
Sounds absolutely wonderful. AJ Betts, thank you so much for being our guest today. It's been such a pleasure chatting to you, and I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Holden.
Now, Love to Read Local Radio is brought to you by Fremantle Press with support from the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Love to Read Local is a celebration of WA's many wonderful writers and illustrators, and it's brought to you by Writing WA. You can check out the show notes for more details about Writing WA, as well as information on how to get a copy of Invisible Boys, Rogue, Hive, or any other book that we've mentioned today. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your favourite podcasts from. Thank you.